This is the beginning of class 10.
What you have to know is the karma involved in the good deed. You have to know the principles of the karma, how to make it a really good deed. And so we're going to talk about this name. Say Jimba.
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 Okay, Jimba means, what's the first perfection?
Giving.
Giving, okay. I like to call it giving, because there's a lot of things, you know. You can give protection to people. You can give donations to people. I mean, generosity for me is like giving a lot of money or something like that. I don't know. I like to call it giving, but it's whatever you like. The Abhidharma starts out by talking about four kinds of giving. Say, Dakhi Junji.
Dakhi Junji.
Dakhi Junji. Dakhi is what, you know? Dakhi means me, okay? Dakhi means me. Or yourself. Dati Junshi means for the benefit of yourself. For your benefit. For your own benefit. And that's the first type of giving in the Abhidharma. And there's millions of divisions of giving. I'm just giving you one. Alright? So the give for your own benefit is this. It's when you give to in the Abhidharma, it's when you give to a temple, or you give to a stupa, or you make offerings at a building. And you're actually putting forth offerings in the building. There's no other non-Buddha person there to accept them. You're doing it for yourself, for your own benefit. There's nobody else there who's going to get anything out of it. The Buddhas don't need your offerings. Okay? They have everything they could ever want. That's the principle of offering. You don't. When you get up into the higher offerings and you're offering to enlightened beings, it's basically for your own benefit. They don't need it all. They have much better things to focus on. I mean, they have their own pleasures. They don't need whatever cookies you can bring. Or just, I mean, when you make an offering, basically it's for the virtue of giving it. Okay. And this, the person here is two kinds of people, right? One is a normal person who's not free of desire yet. And when we say desire in the Abhidharma, in this case, it means desire for the desire realm. Desire for this realm. Can you ever get rid of desire for this realm? What is this realm? First Dalai Lama defines it with two things, you know. Food and sex, okay? That's the main object in this realm that we are interested in. And that's what defines our realm, almost. That's how the First Dalai Lama describes the desire for things, you know. Food and sex, okay? That's the main object in this realm that we are interested in. And that's what defines our realm, almost. That's how the First Dalai Lama describes the desire realm. So is there a way to get... Are you guys warm? Okay. No? Tell me if it bothers you. Two ways to get rid of that desire realm. What are you talking about? Two kinds of desire.
Seeing emptiness.
One is to see selflessness, but the other is what?
Renunciation.
The Abhidharma system.
Generating merit.
The path beyond.
There was a path beyond the world and there was a path of the world. And both of them work. You can remove your desire for this realm. The second one doesn't work permanently. The first one works permanently. So the first one is to see selflessness. You remove your desire for this realm permanently. But the second one is just where you get into deeper and deeper meditations, and then this realm, food, seems to be too coarse for you. You're into more subtle realms of reality. And those are people who can live on a glass of water, or, you know, they don't have any desire for the gross pleasures anymore. And that's called the path in the worldly path. So the person who's making this kind of giving is either still has desire for the desire realm, or what? Which of those other two you're guessing might be?
The first.
The
higher pleasures.
It's the person who's into deep meditation. So he's free of desire realm desire. He doesn't have desire for desire realm objects. Okay? But it's not permanent. That doesn't work completely. So basically, this is a kind of a low person, right? He's giving with some kind of, there's going to be some kind of result in where? It's going to, well, that, and he's going to have some kind of karmic result, which is a sort of a lower pleasure. Yeah.
Did you say it was a no benefit to do this?
No, it's a kind of giving.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a kind of giving where the mind state of the person doing it is not very high. It's still valid, it's still good.
It still is benefit.
You're still going to get a nice samsara kriya. Yeah.
You said it was two kinds of people?
Yeah, it could either be a normal person who hasn't had any realizations at all, giving things, or it can be a person who's actually free of desire for the desire realm, but how to be gift things. Just by going into deep meditations, which always fail, eventually, okay? You always come down, you know that. You know you've gone on a retreat, you came back, you had sort of a glow for a few days, and then you get back to reality, right?
So the largest set is anyone who hasn't seen emptiness directly, and of those two, subset of...
You could say that, yeah. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one is... Shen is the opposite of dark. What are you thinking of? Yeah, other people. In other words, the act of giving is helping the other person. But this act of giving is only helping the person who's doing it, right? There's no one out there getting any big benefit out of it. Other person. But this one, Shenzhen here, is only benefit out there getting any big benefit out of it. Other person. But this one, Shenzhen here, is only benefiting the other person. And the one who's doing it doesn't need it anymore. He doesn't particularly care about it. I mean, he's not looking for some desire realm result for himself. So which person do you think it is? Mm-hmm. Could be.
Mahayana.
I mean, from this, what about, can you guess at it from here? A person who doesn't have desire for the desire. Yeah, who has seen selflessness, all right? So you can say in an Arya, a Pakva, a person who has seen selflessness directly, giving to a person who's not free of desire.
Are you saying that's the only kind of person that would do that kind of giving?
Yeah. Well, in this division, in the sutra, but what you have here is a realized being. When I say realized being, I don't mean an enlightened being. Realized means anyone who's seen selflessness. And he has no longer any desire for the desire realm. He has no hope of any... he's not going to get any samsaric result for himself. He doesn't want any desire realm result. He's not interested in it anymore. Yeah.
He is doing it for an enlightened result.
Well, that... But mainly his... The person who gets a benefit out of it is the other person. The other person is getting some food or is getting some flowers. Or he's trying to help the other person. It is not describing like a bodhisattva attitude or something like that.
So an arya.
But you know that there's two definitions. What are the two parts of a good seed? What are the two maturations, two ripenings? Yeah. I mean, they give you pleasure in the short term and in the long term they give you nirvana and beautiful. So that's understood. Any time a person does a good deed, it's going to have some ultimate result. Yeah.
So if an arya were to make a good deed and a billion people got to see with all the teachings, that wouldn't that also be part of his own bank account?
Yeah, sure. That would be Shendun's here if he didn't have desire for desire. There are arias who do have desire for desire. But the person in this case is free of the desire. He's not looking for any benefit.
I thought you said if they see emptiness, they have no longer
any desire. I said there's only two emotions that you lose permanently that they use the emptiness. What are they? Directly. There's only two tonpas. They're called tonpas. Remember?
Belief in that any other religion would be.
You can't doubt anymore. You get rid of Dunming Gyurgyu. You get rid of all kinds of doubt when you're not sure about Buddhism anymore. Why? You see your future life. And you know how many lives you have. If you want to stop calling me Mike and they start calling you Mr. Buddha. Really? So you go through those experiences. You experience the four noble truths. So you can't doubt it anymore. You experience them directly, and you know you're not crazy. Those two emotions are going on at the same time. And then the second one is what?
The belief in self-existence.
Yeah, intellectual belief in self-existence. Things, when you come down and you look around, things will still seem to be self-existent. But you know you're wrong. You know you're crazy.
So if you know you're wrong, then you would know that.
Right, by definition, yeah, good point. You know, by definition, you know that intellectually there's no such thing as non-emptiness. Mm-hmm. But you still see everything self-existent. You can't stop it. The day you do stop it, you're not arhat.
The day you stop what?
So those, you're an arhat the day you stop that and all the seeds to see that. But that's the difference between arya and arhat.
That wasn't clear to me. Can you say?
The arya knows he's crazy, but he still thinks everything is self-existent. And the arhat destroys the mental box charts to see things as self-existent. And then he's an arya. He's an arhat. That makes him an arhat.
And which is number two? Who's an arya or arhat?
The person here is an arya, and he has no longer has any desire for desire. He's why? Not looking for any payback. In
why isn't he an arhat?
He still sees things as self-existent. The day he gets rid of that tendency, along with his bhakti, he's enlightened. He's at least in nirvana.
Put yourself in
Yeah. Okay. Yika means both, alright? You can read the guy, right? Yika Junchir means for both, okay? For the benefit of both. This is where both people involved are going to get some kind of desire realm benefit out of it. So who do you get? Who's the giver? Somebody still has desire for desire realm. He's still looking for payback in the society. And the person getting it is him. He's also getting it, something to eat or, you know, he's a desire, he still has desire for desire. So both of them still have desire for desire. And they're still both getting something out of it. By now it's obvious that getting something out of it is not such a great getting something out of it. The desire realm is gone. Right? This person's not interested in it.
Arya, how does the Arya fit into the whole thing?
It's a person who doesn't have, I'm sorry, a person who does still have desire. Right? And Arya can still have desire.
So are you saying in number three you only get a desire realm result?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the emphasis here. The person doing number three can be an Arya who still has desire. seeing emptiness directly, but it's still not free of nirvana. Because seeing emptiness directly doesn't remove that particular bad thought. It only gets rid of those two. And the whole goma, the whole fourth path, is for the job of the fourth path, where you keep practicing emptiness meditation, is to get rid of those emotions.
So is it the same motivation in one and three, except you do it to an animate object versus
right.
inanimate?
Right. Now what do you get?
None.
Yeah.
Why can't you give with the non-desire realm result?
You can. This is just a division here. You know, they're trying to emphasize the person that's gotten rid of this desire. You will obviously get results from that. But mostly those are caused by what? What's the main cause for the former?
Perceiving it in meditation.
For being born in the former. Yeah. It's practicing that deep, subtle state of mind in this life. I mean, the main reason, the main highway, what do you call it? Entry ramp? On ramp to the form realm is the form realm meditation in the desire realm. This means for neither. And this is where, I'm going to talk about it. This is where a person. An Arya who's free of desire, what a desire gives to another Arya who's free of desire.
But then what's the purpose of that? Like a millionaire giving
it to a millionaire? How do Buddhas interact, you know? What do you do after you become a Buddha? You know? Come on, you have to think about it.
Do they enjoy the act of giving?
You'll see later. There's two motivations for giving. Giving is a neat subject. I mean, it'd be nice to do a whole class on giving. Because if you did it for 6 weeks, I think you would really get into it deeply. But there's giving, one kind of giving where you're trying to help somebody. And there's another kind of giving where you're trying to honor somebody. And this would qualify as that. So they're like, Buddhas are like constantly honoring each other. So you're so great. No, you're so great. You know? Okay? And they're both right. Well, that's the... Those are four basic types of giving. You have to think about it. It's a deep thing. You know, why are you giving things? Just, what do you really want? You know, do you want to... I mean, this is even assuming you understand karma already. Jesus, this is at the back of the chapter. The Vasubandhu is assuming you already understand karma already, and you're going to get excited about doing something karma. He says, well, but now think about, what do you want? What do you want out of it? You know, is it that you finally figured out the way to get rich, you know? It's possible that if you understood karma, if you had a class about karma, and you finally understood how to actually cause things to occur, that you could then just become a desire realm consumer, you know? I mean, you would set up the reasons for you to get rich. You can now. You have the knowledge. If you want, you can go ahead.
So there's a real incentive to like find the Buddha so you can really give him a present, right?
Well, I mean, you have the knowledge now if you believed it and if you acted on it and if you intellectually had meditated for hours and hours on it, your behavior would change now. If you were that kind of person who wanted a desire on result, and if you were intelligent, then you would just start giving away money to the highest objects you could find, you know, and you would be guaranteed success. But he's saying, you know, consider that. Consequences, you know. The problem is, by the time you get the money back, you might have forgotten how you got it, and you're just suffering again. Poor people suffer because they struggle to hurt others to get enough to live on, but rich people think they deserve it and don't do the good deeds to support it. You know, there's trouble both ways. Those are the four kinds of giving.
Michael?
Yeah.
Is there any discussion that sometimes somebody, because of some kind of emotional problem, can't receive even though they need it?
They're too proud to think it needs something?
Not even necessarily that, but there's some kind of emotional problem. I mean, not something clear cut like money, but something more emotional, and they can't receive it because they just can't receive. There's some kind of.
I think it's kind of a thing like Prita says that. Even if you give a Prita a glass of wine, you know, what happens? before they can drink it, it turns into water. I mean, the same metaphor is happening. It's not attracted to the person by the time they get it. Okay, how can you make your giving better, okay? I mean, if you're really into Buddhism, and you've been for a long time, you start to enjoy, you know, you might enjoy being generous and giving, and then you want to know, you don't have time to do all the kinds of giving you can do. You can't take care of AIDS patients and also study all the scriptures and also go and work and give the money away and also, you know, you can't do everything. And you can get exhausted trying, you know, you have to prioritize your good deeds. So I'm going to go through some things that help you prioritize your good deeds. You know, let's say you want to devote the rest of your life to giving. Well, what's the best thing to do? You know, what would be the most powerful kind of giving to do? So they divided into the person who gives, and then the gift. So those three things, you need to know the most powerful of those three. So first I'm going to tell you how to be, you know, the first one is from your side. Okay. These are seven things that make you a better giver. Okay. I mean, the obvious thing, when I say how can you improve your giving, or how can you decide which is the highest kind of giving, you almost automatically think about, well, I guess Dharma, and I guess helping a Lama, or something like that. But what about your attitude? You see? What could you change in yourself that whatever you gave, it would be a higher kind of gift? So this is something you might not think of. And these are called Pakpin Nojin. Yeah, now we're talking about the giver, which normally you don't think about. You know, what do you have to do from your side for a gift to be extraordinary? Say Pakpe?
Pakpe
Nojin. Pakpe Nojin.
Pakpe Nojin.
Pakpa means, what? You know? Arya. Arya in Buddhism means person who's seen selflessness directly. He's a pretty realized person. Noa means riches. And Dun means seven kinds. Seven kinds of popping onions. These are very, these come a lot in humanity. Popping onions. First one is, wish to skyline. Depa. Depa. Depa means what? Kind?
Mrs. Kylie.
Deva means faith.
Yeah. What does the entire sentence mean? Seven kinds of riches of the Arya?
Seven riches of the Arya. And these are seven personal qualities that you don't have to be an Arya to get them. Aryas have them. But these are seven personal qualities that if you develop them, and if you at least have some inkling of them, and then you give something, the gift is karma. We're talking about manipulating karma. I mean, that's our interest right now. Right. How do you get your karma in the time that you have in the window of opportunity of health and youth and intelligence? You know, how do you make your giving the most powerful that you can? And the first thing is depa. Depa means faith. Faith means understanding the good qualities of high objects, and it's mixed up a lot with admiration in Buddhism. And the example is that you look at the Dalai Lama. And you feel some kind of admiration in the sense that you would like to be like him. That's actually the meaning of faith. It's actually more like what? Emulation or something like that. The meaning of faith in Buddhism is where, like if you have faith in the Dalai Lama, it means you recognize his value and you kind of wish that you could develop that yourself. That's the meaning of faith. It's one of the big meanings of faith. Many kinds of faith.
Doesn't mean belief in this case?
It doesn't mean, I don't know what other kinds of faith, I mean, when I say faith in English, what do you think? I don't know. What do you think?
Taking refuge.
Something
you're not quite
sure about.
Yeah. Right, that's what I think.
No, this is to see the good qualities of that object and to want to emulate it. You know, and that means, you know, you see that, you can take the Dalai Lama as a great example. Like, here's this person who is, you know, what's his career path, what's his job, you know? What's he trying to do? You know, what's his idea of what he's doing for? Is he working for himself? Or, you know, I don't know. He doesn't have any career, really. Just a Dalai Lama. And, I mean, all those good qualities that he has, those are best there. You know?
Is the object only a holy object or any good object? Or
any good object. Any good personal quality.
Of any
I mean, you can have depth about a good quality in a person who's not. You can have faith in a good quality, even if the person that has a good quality is in general pretty much. Something like that. You know? That can be depth. So anyway, you have this belief where you just faith out of knowledge. I like to call it, what do you call it? Educated faith. You understand the good qualities. That's the first thing.
The person does not have the power, but you see the power of it. What that means?
There's a thing in Buddhism called Dhati Nama, which means a sort of a blessing on your eyeball, rose-colored glasses. So everywhere you go, all you see is the good qualities in other people, and that's the desirable thing. You know, you like people so much that you're like a mother who doesn't notice the bad qualities of her kids. She just sees the good qualities, and that's supposed to be a nice state to be in.
No, but the question is, if you give to someone you see as bad, I mean, you see as good, but they're actually bad, and they mitigate because of that person.
Well, if it were to the, if you were seeing his good qualities to the extent that you didn't see that he was murdering other people and you didn't try to stop him, that would be bad. But what I mean is when you're among normal people and all day long you just kind of take some kind of joy or appreciation of their good qualities and you don't concentrate so much on their bad qualities, or of your job or the city you live in or anything else, that's supposed to be a desirable thing, not to know.
So you don't need to emulate them for yourself per se either, Peter?
No, you just see the good parts of people. That's Dhati Nama. It's a very, even in the highest secret teachings, it's very important. And it's just some kind of blessing you have where you don't concentrate on the bad stuff. And you concentrate on the good stuff and try to become that yourself. And that's in the long run, it's a very deep thing. It's a great thing. It comes in the munla, in the doctrine. It's very powerful. Yeah.
But seeing like that is based on your bhakti.
And also you can artificially try to get it. You know, that's not bad to try to... You know, if you're aware that you're in your office and you're... It's not fun and it's not pleasant and it's not productive to concentrate on the lousy qualities around you. So you just purposely try to concentrate on a person's good qualities. And after you do that for a while, you actually start to change. Yeah.
So is this just the same as rejoicing as it's described?
Yeah, very similar. Sujin, what's Sujin, do you know?
Morality.
Avoiding the 10 bad people. And morality sounds boring. I don't know. I wish we had a different word for it. But
they're giving,
the person who's giving, the person who's doing the giving, is trying to develop. If a person who has these 7 qualities inside his heart gives the same thing that another person who doesn't have these 7 qualities gives, the karma is like a zillion times more. That's the point. We're talking about how to increase the kilotonnage of your karma.
This may not be a good analogy.
So you're talking about how to enrich it, right? You know? You're trying to think about how to... Well, so what I'm saying is the obvious thing is to give something more valuable. And the obvious thing is to give it to someone higher. But what they're saying is that if you could try to develop knowingly, purposely, self-interestedly, try to have these while you're giving, then your giving is much more powerful.
Yeah, I think there's a question about this giving. You said giving to a higher.
We're going to get to that.
No, my question is that, I mean, if somebody lower is more needy,
we're
going to
talk about
it.
We're going to talk about that. That's coming.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the most bang for the buck? Is that what you're saying?
Your time is short. I mean, it takes a long time to get convinced that you have to do good things. And then when you get to that point, you don't have much lifetime left, and you have to do the most. You have to do the best things. You have to really concentrate on what you want to achieve Buddhahood in this life. You want to create karmic bhakti, which will flower into a totally different reality. That's going to take some time to do good deeds. Just the normal good deeds ain't enough. It's not going to do it. You know, the Buddha took how many billions of years? It's too slow. You have a chance now. You have to prioritize your good deeds. I'm assuming you already know you have to do good deeds. Now how to make them more powerful? How to get the effect before you end up like Alan Tung? know, we were at his funeral, and it was they painted his face up nice, and he was dead, and his opportunity is gone, and he sat in that chair, and he can't do it now. So you have only a short, you have to know how to get them off.
Okay, bang for the buck. Ah,
okay. Say, Tomoa?
Tomoa.
Tomoa is the real word in Tibetan and for generosity. And that just means, you know, I think I heard the Pope said it very nicely in Giant Stadium or something like that. Don't give your extra. Give your main capital. Don't give your leftovers to other people. Give your, you know, give your real essence. Things that you really give away to what you have. Don't give away what's extra.
Now this this is supposed to be a quality of a person that they're holding in their heart while they're giving.
Yeah.
So
it means be Dongwa, Dongsen Chenpo in Tibetan means be lavish. Don't
be stingy.
Yeah, don't do the you know, giving like you know.
Okay.
Ouch. We call it Pangma Mepa. It's in that prayer. Tupa. Most of them have Tupa in their hearts already. Tupa means learning. Okay. It means Tupa means hearing. And it really does refer to raw classroom hours with a lama, with a teacher.
A study.
Yeah, it's learning. It really refers to how many hours of stuff you've heard. And you need thousands of hours. I mean, it's just a direct correlation, you know. And you just have to become very well educated. You have to know your stuff. And it has to sink in, and that takes repetition, and it takes going back again and again and again. You will study the same thing many times again. And each time it soaks in deeper. And the process is very, what do you call that? It's irresistible. I mean, it does soak in. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of hours. You have to go as much as you can.
And how does that affect when you're giving?
You know what you're doing. No, the awareness of what you're doing is very important, you know. If you understand the emptiness of the object, why you're giving. We are generous now, it's called Henge Gigewa. It means we have some bhaksha from our past lives. We tend to be generous. We're generous people. We may not even understand at all what we're doing. Insofar as you don't understand the mechanics of the process, it's not a very powerful object. If you don't consciously think about this being as empty, I'm giving to this empty being, the gift is empty, the giving is empty, I'm empty, you know, this is going to create an empty result, I'd like it to create this kind of empty result, and you know, if you don't have that, it's not very possible. And you need learning to study that. You know, you have an idea of emptiness right now in your mind. I don't know what it is. I'm not capable to read your mind. But I was reading Jethro Kapa's biography last 2 weeks, and he meets Manjushri. Manjushri comes to sit at the table, but Tsongkhapa can't see him. Umapa is there, one of Tsongkhapa's lamas. And Umapa can see Manjushri. And so Tsongkhapa is dying to ask Manjushri all these questions. So he says, can you, you know, relay the message, you know? And so Umapa says, okay, what do you want to ask her? And he says, ask him if I have a good conception of emptiness, you know, and Umapa says, does he have a good conception of emptiness? He says, well, is my view tending, he's about 22 at this time, I think. No, it's later actually. He says, am I more of a Svatantrika Madhyamika, or am I tending more towards the Prasangika Madhyamika? You know, the two schools of mine. Manjushri says, neither one. Don't compromise. It's really, he's in his early 30s. And where was I anyway? So what it means is you have to the view that you have of emptiness now, but what they say in the book is whatever conception of emptiness you have, use it. But you have to refine it. If Tsongkhapa, after he already had all these students, he already wrote his Namshin Nyingen, his thing. And Manjushri is judging his knowledge as not too hard. We have to refine our knowledge. You know, you have to use whatever knowledge of emptiness you have as you do the giving, but you must refine it. And you must do that. There's no way to do it without knowledge. You know, of study. Yeah.
It sounds like you're going from Abhidharma to Panyanaparamita here.
Not really.
Consistent with the Abhidharma?
Because selflessness. They say you must understand the selflessness.
I mean, do they get into it? To the extent that the Panyanaparamita does with selflessness of the giving, the giver, and the gift.
Their idea of selflessness is, we're not going to go into it.
I mean, it sounds like you were sort of heading toward that right now.
Not that clear.
Next class?
Absolutely on the next class.
If we all survive.
I'm just following the tradition of the First Dalai Lama. When you read his commentary and poetry, you start to wonder if that's really what you're standing on. We don't know if he's thinking there's some wrong on it. He does sometimes. And it's hard to see where he's speaking from. Say, Mosa?
Mosa Shepa.
Mosa Shepa.
Mosa Shepa.
Okay. You had it before. Do you remember Mosa? It's one of the two kinds of reasons why you avoid a bad deed.
Reasons inside yourself.
Yeah, this is the one relating to yourself. This is where you have a chance to do a bad deed in the privacy of your own home. No one will ever know, and you don't, and you avoid the bad deed because of this emotion. You have this quality in you. I think it's conscience is called
self-awareness,
self-esteem, some kind of self-conscience. Maybe I don't know, but it's where you avoid a bad deed for reasons relating to yourself.
So, what are each of those words? That's how
Shepa. This is very Shepa means to know. No is an ancient root referring to your faith, and sa means to be embarrassed, to lose faith almost. To know how to lose faith. I mean, but they don't break it up. It's an idiom. But when you're debating, you go, you should be ashamed to say this stupid thing. That's a classic case in the United.
And so how does that relate to giving, Michael?
What's that?
How does that relate to giving?
It doesn't relate directly to the giving. The person himself is... What he's trying to say is it's not only the gift.
Yeah.
It's not only the person you give to. If you yourself are a higher being, by virtue of these good qualities, the power of the deed is much more powerful. That's just something you would not have guessed maybe. You kind of think that if Saddam Hussein suddenly has a flash and decides to, give something to children, and then if the Dalai Lama came and gave it to the same thing to the same children, it might be the same deed. Assuming Saddam Hussein is a bad guy, I don't know. Then it's not true. The person who has the greater personal qualities creates more good karma. The karma is more powerful only due to his own personal qualities. You know this one, right? What would come next? Huh? Yeah, the person who avoids a bad deed out of consideration for others. He doesn't want others. He doesn't want to offend other people. I didn't write that very well. T-R-E-L-Y-U-P-A. Okay, challenge your problem. He doesn't want to hurt other people. He doesn't want to let down other people. He doesn't want other people to know that he's doing it. It's very important for monks. Monks are supposed to be very careful. We're supposed to avoid the appearance of things as well as this. Reality.
So you call it public reality, maybe? Public morality, rather?
You can say, morality for the public, the way you act in front of others.
Public morality.
Does it, and that involves not only the impression they get, but the repercussions for them. Would this deed hurt other people? A. And then B, would they lose faith in me or lose faith in Jerusalem?
Even if it looks bad, but really isn't?
A monk has to be very careful about those things. Especially a monk. We're like politicians. But in general, there's times when I remember there's a story in the Ramayana that there's a monk who's offering a mandala And he only did it because his sponsor was about to walk in. Normally he's meditating so deeply he can't do his manala. But he wanted to impress his sponsor, who happened to be coming to the door. So he picked up the mandala real fast. Then he caught himself and he threw the mandala on the floor. You know, his motivation right then was very pure, and somebody with clairvoyance praised him a couple hundred miles away at that moment.
Pure when he threw it away.
Yeah, pure when he gave up his suitcase. But obviously it looked bad to the sponsor. But that's a pure action. You know? But no, sometimes there are things when you can't avoid a good deed because someone else might think you're doing something wrong also. There's times when you have the impression that other people may get may be wrong. And if you're sure of your motivation, you're sure what you're doing, that's obviously important. But people who are involved in Buddhism, you know, if you're teachers, then you have to be very careful.
So could that be like a mixed result that was a very pure motivation for him to throw the mandala? On the other hand, if it caused the practitioner to lose some faith or something, it could have been bad.
Yeah.
Whereas the other way around, if you caught yourself and said, well, gee, maybe I should, the practitioner's coming, maybe I should offer the mandala at this time and it will help generate more faith in the practice.
Yeah, it could, either way. Okay, I'll tell you, what's the last one?
Michael, it sounds like it's almost a geometric progression here. Once you start to become a good person, it's like it just self-fueling. Whatever you do.
I was going to point that out, but once you start making progress in one place, you're usually making progress in another place. And once you start screwing up in one place, you're probably screwing up. It's a kind of ecology or a wholeness about you. A holisticness. Once you start getting good at generosity, normally your morality is getting better, your concentration is getting better. They all feel to you. Shut up, I think. Wisdom. Okay. Particularly wisdom about emptiness. It's the result of tuba, right? The result, hopefully. Well, if it's nothing, it's enough. So a person who gives with those, that's what makes what? Seven things which make what?
Powerful giver. A powerful result from the giver.
Yeah. Well, the karma becomes more powerful because of the giver. There's also the giving itself is powerful, and I'll do three short ones and then we'll stop for tea. There's three things that they list about how you do the giving, which make it powerful. So that would be more in the sense of the deed itself. So you want to make it powerful from every angle. Okay, the first one is, they say, an attitude of respect for the person you're giving it to. And that's also divided into your actual physical appearance as you give it. So not only do you give someone something, but you do it very respectfully. And there's many cases of Buddhist kings, you know, they get down off their throne, they come down outside, they go down to the beggar and they hand him the money. And it's considered disrespectful. I mean, in Asia especially, to say, oh, you know, here's the money. Or, you know, you give it to somebody, you give it to them. You know, it's considered respectful. I think you have to apply it to our culture. I don't know.
You're like scoffing a street person while you give him a quarter.
Yeah. Well, my boss, you know, he recently gave a check for... we talked to him and he gave some money just to medicine for his plane. Yeah, he did it pretty nice. He contacted the people who were working on it. And, you know, I spoke to the guys very nicely. And he said, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing. And that kind of, that's, you know, or he could just write out a check and say, you know, give it to them. That's a good one. That's just in your manner, how you do the gift. Second part there is where you... the thing is really needed. You give in time of need. You give what the person really needs at the time. And you know examples of people who are very generous of things you never wanted, you know. Like old ties and stuff. You know, you have to judge the need of the person. The more needy they are. You have to hit the, I don't know what to call it, right time in the right place. You can't give it a couple weeks too late. When they really need it, at the peak of their need, you have to judge the peak of their neediness and give it up. And that's the second thing that makes it powerful. And then the third thing is that when you give it away, it does no harm to other people, by the way. And they give examples of Abhidharma says presenting a goat to a butcher, or giving people poison. You know, if somebody wants to commit suicide, you give them poison. Or you give them food that's not healthy.
You get somebody stoned out of their head on the street, a buck to fur, you know.
You know, I think it really does apply here. If you're sure, you know, you're never sure 100%, but if it's pretty obvious that they're going to hurt themselves further, that particular line is very clear. You have it in your reading. You know, to give them anything which is going to harm their health, even if they want it, and like poison, even if they want it, you can't do that.
You know, I've heard people say, well, in the case of the winos on the streets, that's all they have is their alcohol, and it makes them feel good, so you're actually really, you know, giving them the only thing that can give them any small short-term pleasure.
I think if that's your motivation, it's a nice motivation, but I also think there's this line which is undeniable. I mean, the line is very clear, and also a Buddhist can't give intoxicants to anybody. You're not allowed to give a drop of anything to anybody for any reason. A monk is not allowed to give a drop of alcohol for... I mean, for medicinal reasons, it's very touchy. So,
I don't think he's talking about giving them the alcohol. I think he's talking about giving them the money when they said they're sad.
You know,
needs
very
some breakfast.
Well, they're going to use it for alcohol, and you think there's a very good chance. But I mean, most of us don't give because we don't want to bother them. But you have to judge. You have to judge carefully. Yeah.
Why can't you give a monk a knife?
A knife to a monk? We're talking about he's going to use it to harm himself.
No, but I thought it was generally prescribed that,
what?
that you're not allowed to give knives to...
Oh, I never heard of that. I know there's a Mongolian... Mongolians have a lot of, superstitions. But I never heard of that. To give a knife to a monk? I'm not aware
That's
of it.
That's a gift.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it. I've heard that sharp things were like good luck. Because they like sharp things. You get some pins and needles. You find a needle, it's supposed to be good luck. I didn't hear that, but I haven't finished my United Studies. And I definitely haven't finished. I know how far I am, and I haven't reached all the rules. There might be one that I don't know about. Could be. So those are the three things that make the deed. You do it out of respect. First one. Second one is fun.
Giving time.
You give something really neat. You know, you go and do the necessary thing when it's really hot. You don't show up 10 days later and you don't show up too late and you do it. You know when they're really gonna need you and you come there. It's like when people washing the dishes and you got to the last dish and they say, oh, can I help you? which I usually do. And then what's the third one?
Harm.
Yeah, don't hurt anybody else. You can't obviously can't steal anything to give it to somebody. That's not
Robin Hood.
You cannot do that.
Especially if it's sort of high object.
We'll get to that. But I you know, you have to be careful about it. It's tempting. I've been close to that, and I've been close to, you know, bamboozling some donor and giving $100 more. And you have to be careful. You cannot collect a gift in any illegal, immoral means. You can't do it out of flattery. You can't do it out of hinting to the person. You have to be very upfront, honest. You have to directly ask the person.
Michael, let's say what Tom and Mussolini did was the government would take the grain from the poor people that they were producing in their farm, and they didn't have enough to feed their own family. So that this guy was stealing their, you know, their things to give it back to the people who were poor. So he was stealing, but really, was he really stealing?
That's like Robin Hood, right? No, yeah. We're not allowed to do that. We're not allowed to.
But he was feeding people who were starving.
Yeah, we're not allowed to. Bodhisattva is another thing. I mean, Bodhisattva is about... It's conceivable, a Bodhisattva... You can break your Bodhisattva about really, if it's really important. I mean, you can break your... causing moksha about immorality though. A bodhisattva, person with bodhisattva about might be required. But that's a different thing. We're not doing that. Generally speaking, you don't need to, and it's a good idea. Everybody likes bodhisattva, so they think they apply it now. And the method of giving, right? And now we're going to cover the four qualities of the person that you give the thing to. And the first one is called Droa. Droa means realm of being, okay, or what kind of being that you're giving it to. So, like, the choice is for us, since we can't see hell being, and we can't see hungry girl, and we can't see the only two realms we can see are animal realm and human realm, if you are who you seem to be, I don't know.
Can't
think
Buddhas.
Well, they're out of all the realms. They're not even realms. So, anyway, is it better to give to an animal or to a person? There's a hierarchy. It's much more powerful to give it to a human. And if you have a choice, you could have possibly affected this person. As a human, he has the potential. An animal doesn't have the potential. It's much more important to give it to a human. Droa means type of being, you know, human, animal. And obviously, if the human is a very good person and has a good chance for getting into Dharma, then that would even be a better Droa. So first of all, it's the kind of being this person is.
But then it almost indicates that the giving has to do with
the potential for this person to benefit ultimately from just giving it. Yeah, very important. And you know, and I remember when I first read it, I was into dolphins and stuff.
No, but you think giving to somebody who's starving versus giving to somebody who's
it's coming. Oh, now that you mention it. What Emil, you know? Yeah. The Dumyal is also, if you give it to a person who's Dumyal, it's a lot more powerful. Dumyal means suffering. Someone who's hungry, someone who's cold, someone who's sick. Much more powerful. If the person is really in need, if the person is really suffering.
What was the question?
First one is what type of being he is. Is he animal or human?
Right.
Okay. The second one is he in suffering? Is he in obvious suffering? That's the second thing. If you give the same thing to a person who's in great need or who's in pain, much more powerful coming. Say Kemba?
Kemba
means assistance, and this refers to people who have given you great assistance. If you give something to someone who's given you great assistance, and this always refers to what?
Your parents.
Your mother and father. Okay, why?
Because they give you your body.
Keep that in mind, you know, we talked about it before. People say, my parents weren't such cool parents, my mother really didn't care about me, or it's not the point. The parents have given you assistance because they gave you a body. Once they've given you a body, they did something so important that you have to. They are now a very powerful karmic object for you. Once they have given you a body, and in fact, it's the two substances that come from the mother and father that ultimately can be very important to you later in your higher practices. That they've given you that opportunity. They supplied you with that physical body. And that's a great thing already. They're already a very powerful karmic field. You have to be very careful towards them. And if you give them something, it's much more powerful.
Somebody sells their egg.
We talked about it.
No. I'm not
going to
ask
you
that question.
All right.
Is it considered bad?
No, it's not bad. I mean, it depends. There is this thing about giving away your body parts and things like that, but if you do it for money, it's much less virtue than if you do charity. But it's still, if your intention is that this other woman should have a child or can't have a child, that's no problem.
Sometimes, but with parents, could it ever mean?
Obviously, it would by extent. You have meaning what?
Teachers.
I think so. Ultimately.
So we could take this the other extreme, the negative.
But the Abhidharma usually messages, but they also do messages.
So by inference, you could take this to the other extreme and say it's really bad news to be angry at your parents.
Oh, very bad, very bad. Even if all the circumstances are, even if they deserve it in a sense, it's very bad because of the power of the object. Very, very potent karmic object. If you can't be nice to them, at least be neutral. Okay. All
right.
And that's a thing in America. It is Yintin. Okay, Yintin. Yintin. Do you remember Yintin? Comment to that name. Let me get this. Anyway, it means good quality. Good, it means high spiritual quality. These can all be, I mean, this can be out of a, giving is supposed to have two modes. One mode is where you're trying to help the other person. But the other mode is where you're trying to honor, you're trying to show, you know, the Dalai Lama doesn't need your flowers and your food and your cookies and, you know, but you just want to be there at the Kala Chakra, but you want to make sure you offer something because, just to honor his presence, you know, to say, you know, I honor who you are. And that's a Yindeng Jishin. You know the classic example in Abhidharma as well. I think we had it before. People who had just come out of certain states. What was the obvious one?
When they just saw Arjuna.
Yeah.
Person.
I mean, that's obviously the person who's just, especially when he's just come out of that state, anyone who does anything to him is magnified. Just a person who's seen selflessness directly, anything you do good towards them or bad towards them is magnified. Very much more powerful from them.
I think they're oftentimes turning around and giving it to someone else then.
There's a famous story that after this Lama died in Tibet, he was a hermit and people used to, you know, shower him with presents and stuff. And after he died, they found all his coins and clothes and food. He lived near a cliff, you know, he used to go and throw found all his things. Yeah, and they never used them, it doesn't matter.
Explain before a little bit more what you mean by that is high spiritual quality.
It means that person, regardless, he doesn't need your offering, but you're honoring him. You know, you meet the Dalai Lama and you offer him a flower, and that flower given to the Dalai Lama is much more powerful than the same flower given to you. I'll give you an example when Tsongkhapa in his previous life met the historical Buddha. And he was from Chamsen Q, he's a certain person, and he offered the Buddha a rosary, a crystal rosary. And according to tradition, that deed helped him become so intelligent in his life. It's just because of the power of that deed. And he was dragged to that Buddha by Manjushri, Bodhisattva.
So, what's the hierarchy? Like, let's say you have $5 in your pocket.
Well, I love this question. I'm hoping someone will ask this question. We're talking hierarchy now, but what do you do with the $5? I don't want to say. I mean, you consider all these things. I'm going to give you one more list. Abhidharma loves lists, as you may have noticed. And by the way, it's easier to remember things if you know what the sixth is and the five. There's whole dictionaries in Tibetan, the five beasts and the six masters. I'll give you the data. You can figure it out. But I like the question because your resources are limited and your time is limited and your mind is the time of your own mind. No, I mean the time space. The minutes that your mind will be clear in this life are numbered. You'll have, you know, so many hundreds of hours of clear thinking left in your life. And then it just gets fuzzy and old and you can't do these things. So really, seriously, so you have to do these things when you're... It is an important decision. I'm glad that someone occurred to someone, well, now what shall I do? Shall I reprioritize my giving? That's the whole idea. You decide from the information. You have a reading.
What about the three categories? Is one more important than another?
I don't remember any... I said Yindeng Yixing. I have a feeling they are increasing more important. I have a feeling that
the object is the most important.
Yeah, if you give to a, you can read in the reading, and he bases it on sutra. And sutra says if you give something to a person who's just in selflessness, you know, showing the times you're powerful. Okay, I'm going to give you a new idea.
$5
and
you give it to the
Dalai
Lama. Really, he doesn't need that $5,
but
somebody started, you need that $5.
So then you give it to the Dalai Lama. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And you have to study to accept that. It's hard to accept that.
You
have to think about it. Dalai Lama tells you to give the purpose of the event. But I don't want to draw those conclusions for you. You read. You can read the Abhidharma. I gave you a reading.
Give it.
Oh, I will. Maybe I'll do it now. But I have one more idea to tell you about. Say, Jela Sakpa.
Jela Sakpa.
Che means committed. La here means end. Sakpa means collective. Okay, and this is a feature of karma. You can have karmas which are committed but not collected. You can have karmas which are collected and committed. Committed and collected, and etc. Neither committed nor collected. What it means is this particular karma is going to stay with you and be stored more firmly in your mental strength if it has six qualities. It's a distinction made in the Abhidharma.
Collected meaning ripened?
No. Meaning stored in your... If we go back to the higher schools, the bhakshak is really firmly planted into your mental strength.
How could any karma not be...
You can debate the Abhidharma. And I like the question. Oh, we'll get into it, by the way. We would like to reach a point where we do chela mataka. We did it, but we don't have to... We can unstore it, you know, unactivate it. That's the whole idea. And the review class is very important. The next class is, week from Thursday. And it's very, very important. We're going to talk about... This is going to lead into how to deactivate the seed. Right? And we'll do a little bit of that while we do our review. So six things that make the deed... The first thing is it's done intentionally.
Okay.
Six things that make it very firmly stored. Not only committed, but also stored.
So this is a good thing we're talking about.
Either way. The intention plants it more firmly.
Are you saying there are only two options? Committed and collected, or committed and not collected?
They give all four moves, okay?
All right.
Not committed. I don't quite see how you can collect it but not commit it. Well, I didn't, to tell you the truth, I didn't read it very carefully. They do say there's such a thing. I don't know. Maybe it's where you did a mental deed but you didn't act it out. Maybe it's committed and you actually act it out. We had that before. Do you remember what it entailed? The empathic karma basically had that four takes right now. And those four, and this is interesting because the Abhidharma is more clear than Jetson Kapa was actually on this point. That if you have all of those complete, the karma is more powerful. It's just much more powerful. If all four are complete, I mean the Abhidharma is six and they include the other four. You don't have to. I'm not going to redo that because it gets confused.
But this again sounds negative. Then.
This is negative. What would be the positive stuff?
Joy.
Rejoice. So, no regret means you do the bad deed, you do a bad deed, and somebody asks you, you know, this is also in the court of law, right? They ask the guy, you know, are you sorry what you did? He said, no, I kind of enjoyed it. And then they give him 20 more years. You know? Karmically also. You have no regrets about what you do. And the karma is much more. In the case of giving, it's rejoicing. To be happy over what you do good really magnifies the karma. Much more powerful karma. Probably I should have done a homework question like design the ideal karma. They have to, in the computer magazines, the guy goes and he buys the best monitor and the best chip. And, he collects the ultimate computer. You could do the ultimate good deed. You know? Give me all the elements of the ultimate good deed. What's the ultimate object? What's the ultimate motivation? You know, what's the ultimate thing you could give? You know, you could do that. Number four. No antidote.
Yeah, what does that mean?
We're going to talk about antidote next class.
I mean after this.
Yeah, but what it means is...
In a good sense.
But you don't do anything to make up for it. In the concept which develops from the Abhidharma, you can see now it's rooted in the Abhidharma. In the concept of the four forces, where you try to purify the bhakshak, you try to deactivate them or ruin their ability to produce a result. This is very important. Antidote means you do something to make up for it. You try to make up for it.
But it, in a positive way, it would be sort of like maybe just allowing it to grow, you know, to become more generous or something?
No, I can't think. Maybe just to continue.
Yeah, I would think that allow this, what you're giving to like...
Multiply.
Yeah.
Number five. By the way, what's the most powerful of all antidotes? The Lama Rinpoche says.
What did she say?
Meditating on that. You know, I used to do that. You know, in my confession. You just go home and you just try to meditate on something. You did a very bad deed and you want to purify it.
And you see the emptiness of it?
By the way, if you saw the emptiness of it, what would you see?
That you didn't do it and you didn't do it.
No, you see absolutely how certainly it's going to happen. It's not the opposite. We will. Right? I mean, when you understand the emptiness of your bad deeds, then you're going to start shaking. Because then you know that they work. Number five.
So, Michael, how come there's intention twice? Intention is in number two also.
I think he means here. They do overlap. I mean, the other ones are going to overlap also. But I think here he means the idea of all four elements being complete.
Oh, but intentional is not the same as intention, is it? That's the idea.
Well, it does. There's two Tibetan words. Sam Shintu means it's knowingly. And you could say knowing the consequences, you know, knowing what's supposed to be happening, you still do it. And then kunlong, which is the word intention, means, you know, you want to do this thing. It's your full intention to murder somebody. It's not that you hit them by accident in a car. Because the sam shindu would be almost unthinkingly. You know, unintentional means unthinkingly. But with no intention means you didn't have that specific intention to kill somebody. You killed them by accident. Number five is... Number five is with the attendant. There's a debate in the Abhidhamma, and there's two viewpoints about what it means. The easiest one to remember is what you hear in the Lam Rim, where they say, when you're done with the deed, you take some joy in a bad deed. And obviously in a good deed, it would be the same thing. You did it, and after it's all done, it's kind of the wrap-up. The idea of a wrap-up, mental wrap-up, you say, you know, the guy is there on the floor, he's got the knife sticking out of him, his breath stops, and he's like, I did enjoy it in a bad deed. And obviously in a good deed it would be the same thing. You did it, and after it's all done, it's kind of the wrap-up. The idea of a wrap-up, mental wrap-up, you say, you know, the guy is there on the floor, he's got the knife sticking out of him, his breath stops, and he's like, I did. That's called an attendant. That's kind of satisfaction that you did it. You know, it's not the same. That's the easiest one to remember. I think this is more describing the whole thing. You know, I think it's the last one, and it means sattva, the idea of collected. I think he's trying to explain the idea of collected. Collected means it's going to give you a concrete result. And I think it's almost a result of all the other five. I don't think it's hard for me to conceptualize it as a different category altogether. It more or less, to me, it defines the idea of being collected. Collected means you cemented that seed to have this perception later in your mind. It's now cemented in there that you're going to experience this result. You will perceive yourself having that result. And I think that's part of the... idea of collection.
Yeah. I don't really understand. You know, number two, it's already been described. That the complete path of karma has everything that will cause a full karma.
It's actually six elements, and I don't have time to learn. They're basically the ones that you learned before.
But so given that number two is the complete path of karma, and says these are the four steps, everything will karmically ripen fully. Why is this of any consequence in one?
The other one?
Yeah, they had one, three, four, and.
I think what the Buddha is doing now. Remember the Abhidharma. You know, if I was a college professor, I would say, you know, you can see that from this Hinayana, crude Hinayana belief, the sophisticated Mahayana belief comes out later of the four forces. But I think If you're a Buddhist, you have to say the Buddha is setting you up mentally for the four courses. They're coming next class. But it's the idea specifically of he's setting you up for the idea that if you did have regret, if you did do some antidote, you know, you could somehow, maybe you could affect those karmic seeds in your mind, in your being. Maybe you could do something. I think he's setting up for that idea. Sutra is not always cut and dry. You know, sutra is not always, they don't overlap or they don't subsume each other. The divisions are not always strict divisions. Sometimes they overlap with each other. And that's no problem as long as you know which ones overlap and you can define it. Okay.
Anyway, talking about karma, the path of karma.
Yeah.
He's saying karma is the movement of the mind.
Right.
And the path of karma are the actions.
I thought those four things all together.
I thought the definition of karma was the movement of the mind and what follows.
Yeah. Yeah.
So any action that follows from the movement of the mind is still karma.
That's true.
So what we're saying is,
yeah,
there's
three possibilities, right? Something which is a karma but not a path of karma. Something which is both a karma and a path of karma. And something which is only a path of karma and not a karma.
But I'm saying, since the path of karma is defined as what you go out and do,
right? It's a very tricky thing, and it's not too clear to me, but apparently it has to have all six of those elements in it, or those four.
But see, what I'm saying is, since karma is defined as what follows the movement of the mind,
it means both are karma.
Right.
The movement of the mind is karma.
The path of karma.
And what it instigates is karma.
But I understood the path of karma should not be karma. You're saying the path of karma is not
karma.
No, it
is. In the case of the first seven bad deeds, it's both.
Right, but in the last three,
it's not.
But my point is...
They're not karma. They're path of karma.
That's my point. Is how can a path of karma not be karma if karma is defined as the movement of the mind and what follows?
Oh. What they say when they say what follows... It's only subsumed by physical and verbal deeds.
What do you mean subsumed?
I mean, they can only be physical or verbal. They can't be mental.
Well, the movement of the mind is mental.
Right. When they say "deni samba dande che," which means karma is a movement of the mind and what it instigates.
Yeah.
The words "what it instigates" only refers to the first seven bad deeds.
I understand, but you're saying the last.
But the movement of the mind
is karma.
Yeah. It's a. The point is this. It's a separate mental event from the anger or the desire. It's going along in the same mind with them, but it's a separate mental function. And that's the point. And in fact, when you get up to Svatantrika, Madhyamika, they define dirty karma as karma which is instigated as the movement of the mind instigated by the bad thought of one of those last three.
How can you have a thought that's not a movement of the mind?
Well, all thoughts are accompanied by movements of the mind. That's the point. You see, when you're talking about the last three, you're talking about a strong emotion.
I'm not quite sure.
A bad emotion.
I see.
And the emotion is separate from
the mind and mental functions are separate, is all they're trying to say.
No, the two mental functions going on in the same mind at the same time are separate. But they are linked in five ways. They're focused on the same object. They have the same coloring towards the object. They are simultaneous towards the object. They're based on the same sense organ. You know, like if you're pissed off by what you're looking at, they're based on the same eye. You know, and those are all, they are equivalent in those respects, but they're not the same. They are independent of each other. And then one Buddhist school says the sutrists, the Dodebas, South Tradition, say, no, it's the last three are karma. So, I mean, it's even a debate in.
Okay. Another question is the idea of the perception, the bhakshak that you create.
Mm-hmm.
If someone yells at you, and you perceive it as being yelled at and as being unpleasant,
right.
Is that planting a bhakshak so that next time you get yelled at, that you will be perceived being yelled at as being unpleasant? Versus if you kind of fool yourself, you know, like, oh, that wasn't so bad that he yelled at me. You're planning a box shot to not perceive being yelled at as so unpleasant next time.
Oh, it helped. It helped. Yeah. But it's not the main karmic cause.
Of perceiving it as pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah. I mean, the result, the karmic result of attempting to perceive his emptiness at that time is separate from the another event in which an older karmic cause makes somebody yell at you.
You see, I'm not talking about perceiving as emptiness. There are a lot of people that go around just trying to fool themselves, like pretending that it didn't hurt or pretending that it wasn't unpleasant. I'm wondering if that...
It's a virtue if it's if your intention is not to get angry, you know, and not... But if it's like one of these weird New Age things where they say... or when they explain emptiness poorly and they say, oh, the guy's not really there and there's no reason to get mad.
No, I'm thinking more they're just people that want around and always be nice, go around and always be nice and always be happy, and they're in denial in a way.
But it really could be their perception.
Well, okay.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
There is a denial thing. There is a... I believe there's both. I believe there's people who honestly don't see the bad there.
Well, that's a whole other matter, though. I'm saying if somebody is conscious and saying, well, if I just trick myself,
Is not based on Shantideva said it's okay. Shantideva and Nagarjuna both spend their whole book, Surleka, Shiching, the friendly letter, letter to the friend, and Bodhicharvatara. They both start out with all these tricks of how to fool yourself into not being bad. And then at the, and then the classic thing is in Surleka. Nagarjuna is halfway through the book, and somebody says, "Well, how can a monk not have desire for women?" And he says, "Well, look at the poop coming out, and the snot coming out, and everything's coming out." And then he says, "But that won't help much. See your emptiness." And then the whole rest of the book is emptiness. You know, that's his excuse for starting his explanation to emptiness.
In Majjhimika Prasangika, I understand the whole aspect of the bhakti shock generating our perception of the event. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand is the aspect of the data that's out there that arises.
I know. I like this. I know what you mean, and I like it.
I don't understand how that karma causes that data to function in a certain way.
I know what you mean. When, according to my understanding, your highest correct view, when you look at a guy at work and he's angry at you, you are getting outside,
data,
objective, sensual data
input
that you're interpreting.
Right. And what causes that? How is this karmic function to cause that? To
as soon as you focus on that, as soon as you ask me this question, as soon as you're focusing, as soon as you're focusing on the redness of his face and the volume of the decibel level of his voice and stuff like that, then you're conceptualizing those also.
Yeah.
And there are external sensual data.
Right. It's all my perception.
That conceptualize those. And when you back up one step again, and you're just thinking about the guy, then the red face and those things are outside sensual data. They're the data on which you're basing your conceptualization. But when you go down to study his redness of his face and why you see it as anger, then the data is the parts of the red patch.
Well, that's all from the perceptual side, which I've got.
That's also from the optic side. You're asking.
I'm asking what causes
does the glass of water
arise?
Change when the yidak puts it to his lips? Yes. The water takes one aspect.
Right. And so my question is, how does karma impact that? What is the mechanism, the functioning mechanism that causes it to do that?
It was in the queue. It was prioritized by power of the karma, and it ripens first before the other. You know, whichever one was more powerful, according to all these factors, you know, ripened first. And you had the karma to want to study his redness space.
Okay, I'm just going to have to let go of this one.
No, I like the question. It'll occur to you.
I
know, it's slippery.
I guess, I don't know if it's the same thing, but what links the seed with the objective constituent of that which you then perceive as the right thing to perceive.
Mine only says, you know, the same seed, the reason they're called mine only, is created the objective data and your perception.
Right, but that would not be in the...
Yeah.
In the
We don't believe... We accept the principle that the object is coming from the same common seed. We accept that. We don't say that they were both expressions of some seventh consciousness called Alayavijñāna.
Right.
That's
right.
The only difference.
So in
that used to bother me in the monastery. He said, right. It sounds great to me, you know, why can't we accept that? He said, my teacher said, it was like one of the most profound things he ever said to me. He said, oh, we accept that. We just don't believe you have to say it in Alayavijñāna.
Right, right.
So it's, there's more of that.
Okay, last question. What I understand as far as powerful objects go, you know, the idea of benefiting more beings, making them a powerful object. Mm-hmm. What makes inanimate objects powerful? Objects of karma to perform an action.
We said, you know, religious books, religious temples.
Why are they powerful? But since they're not.
If their potential to act as a jedang of wisdom, and we had that.
What's a jedang?
Jedang was when we studied the word Abhidhamma. Was that it? It's the real Abhidharma is wisdom and it's accoutrements. And then there's real accoutrements and symbolic accoutrements.
Well, like a stupa, walking around, a circumambulating stupa. Yeah. I mean, that.
Yeah.
How is that a powerful object?
Because of its relation to the act of escaping suffering.
Which is what? How is circumambulating stupa?
Oh, it contains the remains of some person who had deep insight into that. And when people see the stupa, they'll think of it. And
but the idea is even without thinking, the benefit of a fly going around.
Yeah, there is.
So how is that a powerful object for the fly going around?
Oh, if the fly has no conscious awareness of the holiness of the object.
Yeah, it's thing.
No, they say it works. I don't know. Yeah. I know what you mean, yeah. No, and they say it the opposite way, that if you kill a person and he's a judge on the arhat, you didn't know it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So we don't know why the fly traveling around...
Well, if I was in a debate ground, I'd say, well, he's going to... Just by being in the presence of that object, he's creating a bhakcha to see that object more in the future, and when he's born as a human, he'll see this object, and he'll wonder what's inside, and he'll, you know, something like that, maybe?
Well, it makes it a normal bhakcha, necessarily, not necessarily a powerful object.
It has the potential to turn into a human being's curiosity or attraction to stupa, which people have, and sometimes you don't know why. You know, some guys are, you know, obsessed with taking pictures of Tibetan stuff, and they don't know why. Some people are attracted to the letters, you know, they get thing when they see the... Many people have told me when they see those Tibetan letters, they freak out. You know?
I was at Century 21.
Yeah.
They have leather coats with Tibetan script embroidered around the sleeves. It's like a golf, you know, high-end leather coat. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know what it says, but it's
right. This fool asked me for something I know.
Like I just wanted to do that.
Sasi Bhurghi Jusimne Tavsham Viravin Sinyamde Yampadi Sange Sindhu Mitte Uwagi Jogunanda Simha
Class 10.